Good afternoon, everyone. Today, we're going to open up a simultaneous public hearing on five bills that would modify Oregon's state tax. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188, 304, 319, 674, and 701. And Kyle is with us to just give us a brief overview of how this tax works, and I'll let you take it away, sir.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In the meeting materials, not under any of the bills, but just the general meeting materials, you'll find a few slides on the estate tax, and the idea just be to be a rough or a quick overview and history of the estate tax and how we got to where we are today. Just diving right into that. So Oregon's estate tax, I figured what I'd do today for the overview is just start with where we are today and then go to the history and then bring you back up to where we are today, because there has been a bit of changes over the last 20 years or so interacting, Oregon's estate inheritance tax interacting with the federal tax. So picking up on the second slide, is just the current Oregon estate tax, the more or less a flow chart. And similar to what you've seen in some of the other tax programs that we have, it just kind of walks you through how you go from the value of the estate and then you get down to the actual tax liability that an estate would be subject to. So step one is just the total gross estate. So that's such things as cash, stocks, bonds, the real estate, those sorts of things. Subtract deductions. That could be outstanding debts, again, like something like a mortgage for a piece of property would then lower the value of that property in the estate, and that equals your taxable estate. From there, you'd multiply that by the Oregon tax rates, and I have a slide on that later just highlighting those, and that equals your Oregon estate tax. The next step, and this is for estates that are perhaps both inside and outside of Oregon, so it's not just an estate that's all within the state, but an estate that could have property in multiple states. Something to that effect, you have an Oregon percentage that then gets applied to more or less apply the Oregon estate tax and control that for the amount of the estate that's here in Oregon compared to outside in other states. That leaves you with the tax payable in Oregon. There's then the application of the natural resource credit if that is applicable, and I'll get into that in a little more detail shortly, and that at the end there finishes with the net estate tax. And again, once I get into the rates, I'll talk about where it's the threshold, so to speak, for the Oregon estate tax is an estate that's $1 million or more. And that'd be the gross estate, so not just the estate here in Oregon, but the gross estate. So it could be the value of property here in Oregon with property maybe in another state, Washington, California, something like that. If that total value of the estate is over $1 million, you do have to file an estate tax form. Okay, so just a general recent history. I'll try to do this fairly briefly, but beginning in the late 1980s and going through the early 2000s, Oregon, along with many other states, was utilizing what was referred to as the pickup tax. And it was more or less utilizing or piggybacking off of the federal estate tax. At the federal level, there was a credit for estate taxes paid at the state level. So the credit was $1 for $1 up to a certain amount. So it essentially a state could impose an estate tax and it would just reduce that estate's tax liability at the federal level. So you could, essentially the idea was a state could impose an estate tax and it wouldn't change the net tax liability for an estate when you were looking at both the federal and the state estate tax. But it was, so a number of states were taking advantage of that. In 2001, under EGTRA, the federal government made some changes that started to phase out that state tax credit. And that essentially caused a lot of changes to have to be made in not only in Oregon, but in other states as well that were utilizing this pickup tax, so to speak. Because the full phase out of that state tax credit would be in place in 2005. So it forced some changes in the states, Oregon being one of those. Oregon responded in 2003 with House Bill 3072, and in some cases it was a bridge between the next change we had, and that was trying to utilize fixing at a point in time to the federal estate tax. Oregon was more or less disconnected, you kind of think of it, from the federal level and fix at that point in time. That was ongoing for a number of years until the 2007 and 8 sessions where some changes were made. And then ultimately in 2012 and 2015, really 2012 was the change where Oregon's inheritance tax became the estate tax. And at this point, Oregon, other than connecting to a few definitional terms at the federal level, Oregon's estate tax is its own entity. And in part, that's due to the changes of the pickup tax and then a number of other changes, which I won't go through, but I've highlighted related to the federal changes of the last 15 years or so, where there's been a number of changes where the estate tax, in some cases, was scheduled to go away, and then it came back due to budget reasons and the way the Fed set it up. They didn't get rid of the federal estate tax ongoing, but they just phased it out more or less for a number of years. So there's been a lot of back and forth at the federal level that would make it difficult for Oregon as well as other states to more or less leverage the federal estate tax. That's kind of the upshot there from all that. Slide number 5 has the rates and for Oregon's estate tax. And again, you can see it doesn't kick in until over that $1 million. And these are marginal rates that increase as the value of the estate goes up. You can see that beginning at 10%, all the way up to the highest rate at 16%. Now, Oregon does have a natural resource credit. It's available to certain estates, and they have to, you know, as the name suggests, natural resource property, which would include farm use, forest land use, and commercial fishing business operations. The slide in front of you gives some information on how the natural resource credit works. A couple things just to highlight is the gross value of the state must be less than $15 million. And the use requirements of the property, there are requirements that the property has to have been used in that farm or forest or commercial fishing operations before and then following the death as well to continue to use that in years following as well. So it's keeping it in that natural resource use to get the credit. And then the final couple slides I have are just some background on the estate tax receipts to give the committee some sense of what the receipts have looked like. They have been up over the past couple of years. We have seen a couple larger estates that have been paying the tax, so that has been a bit of an uptick as well. And the state economist has hit on that in some of the revenue forecasts as well, on whether we'd expect that going forward or that's just a couple of years where we've seen some of the larger estates. And just to give you the last slide, give you some sense of where's the burden of the estate tax and how many estates are filing this. You can see the number of estates that are filing and then also the payable tax broken down by the value of the estate. So it gives you some sense that about, and this was in tax year 2017, but about 38% of the total payable tax was from estates greater than $10 million or more. But you can see in terms of number, that's a relatively small number of the estates are that large.
Did you briefly want to go through a sentence or two summary of the bills that we have open for public hearing? We have a couple of the sponsors of some of those bills ready to come up. In fact, let's bring up Senators Thatcher and Hansel together. I know you're on different bills, but we'll
Senator
get...
Knopf's should,
and Senator Knopf is here, too, and I know our own Senator Buckwitz, you're on one of these.
Mine's identical to Senator Thatcher's.
So. Okay. So why don't you give us a quick rundown?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So in the meeting materials, there is an SMS for each of the individual bills, but I put together a table that just lists the bills and then the changes in the measure description. So you can reference that. We have, I guess, SBs 319 and 674 are full repeal of the estate tax. Senate Bill 188 is allowing an exclusion from the taxable estate of an amount not to exceed the lesser of $500,000 or the value of the principal resident. And that applies to deaths on or after 1/1/2020. Senate Bill 304 is an exclusion of the taxable estate for family-owned farm or business property that then is, following the death, is given or passed on to another family member. That's 1/1/20 as well, effective date. And then the final one, Senate Bill 701, is specifying that the Oregon estate tax, it's more or less aligning where Oregon's estate tax kicks in or becomes applicable to the federal threshold as well, which is $11.4 million rather than the $1 million we have right now here in Oregon. So that's aligning it with what the federal level and indexing that number to inflation as well. And that one would begin 1/1/2019.
Okay. This is a very attractive panel. Senator Thatcher, why don't you start first and tell us what bill you're on?
Well, I'm in support of, I think, all of them that you said.
Okay.
But my bill is 319, and it, what's that? Oh, I'm sorry. I should know better. I am Kim Thatcher. You said my name, so I just felt like that was enough. I'm the senator from Senate District 13, and I think we've probably all heard stories of people in our district, especially farmers, who get impacted, their families get impacted by the death of the head of the family, and instead of being able to continue on their business, they are stuck having to break up the business, essentially, in order to be able to afford to pay the taxes. There's a story of an Oregon farmer, Pauline Andrews. Her grandparents died, and then the family had to pay thousands of dollars in, I call them, death taxes in order to keep the land that had been in their family for over a century. And then they'll have to pay it again when her parents die, and then they'll have to pay it again when she dies. It just, it's not a good thing to do, I don't think. So, families can get hammered, and it hurts Oregonians, especially in land-based sort of businesses. And rather than having taxation without respiration, let's fix Oregon's estate tax laws. Thank you.
Okay. And that, and it was 319. Any questions of Senator Thatcher? You mentioned a farm in that case. So how does the farm change that was done about 10 years ago help her situation, or what's, sounds like there's a conflict there.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the natural resource credit does have a limit of the $15 million estate, so that could be one area where it wouldn't be applicable, depending upon the value of the estate.
So I think in your slide there, you diplomatically said Oregon attempted to preserve family-owned farms, but it's up to $15 million.
Yes, Mr. Chair, with land values going up so much, that doesn't go far enough for a lot of families that have farms in our state.
Okay. No further questions. Senator Knope, I'll let you.
Questions, Mr. Chair.
I said no further questions. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're not going alphabetically, Bill. So I'm going to go first, I guess. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, State Senator Tim Knope, representing Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. This is probably my fourth bill. I put this bill in every session, so Senate Bill 701. And when I started this effort, actually back in the House, there were a minority of states who had exemptions for state death taxes. And now that number has risen to more than half the states. I actually lost track of the number. I think it was in the 30-something of states that, do you have the number? Of, I can't count that quick. There's a lot of
38.
Them. 38. There are 38 states now that do not have death taxes or have death taxes that are better than what the federal death tax is. And I think my goal is to sync Oregon with our federal death tax, although I think mine is at 11.4 million, so I'm not sure if that's the exact number. But as always, I am open to a discussion and amendment from the amazing Senate Finance Committee and all the knowledge that you have. And so I think we just need to make progress, because ultimately what's going to happen is Oregon is going to be uncompetitive as it relates to keeping our wealth and resources here. Because when somebody leaves the state, and I've talked to many people who have left Oregon as a resident to go to another state where they can better prepare for their ultimate demise and their estate planning. but amazingly, they still seem to spend a little less than half the year in Oregon, and so they're still benefiting. But what happens is we lose that interest from those people in continuing to donate and put their resources into Oregon, and they sometimes direct those resources into the new state to which they have moved, although they tend to enjoy Oregon and its amenities, especially Central Oregon, because who wouldn't enjoy Central Oregon? And so I just think over time, I did see the chart and that we've increased our collection of death taxes over the last few years, but I ultimately think that that is going to change. And so I think at some point we're going to have to do this. I would just prefer to do it before those people have left Oregon for good, that have the ability to be a benefit to our communities and donate in many other ways. And so I would just encourage you to review this particular policy in light of maybe, I don't know, other changes that may be made to the tax code, because I think this one ultimately is going to be counterproductive to Oregon and our ability to collect these taxes long term. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Questions of Senator Knope? Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Hass, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Hansel, State Senator from District 29. As I shared in an earlier testimony, my district has snow from one end of it to another, or from the Dalles Dam to Hell's Canyon. So it's a pretty good size. And it's a home to many, many farms and ranches and small businesses. But as a member of a long time Oregon farm family, and I think we're in our fifth generation of farming the piece of ground that my ancestors got began to farm in which I was raised, I'm happy to support this bill, sponsor and support Senate Bill 304. It's a little bit different tweak. I've submitted different types of bills through the years in my now seventh year of being in the state Senate. But this one has a particular focus on it. Our family farm was literally almost lost due to the inheritance tax bill when my grandparents passed away. That was over 50 years ago. And what saved our ranch is that my grandfather, during the Depression, bought what was called a schoolhouse section, which now is up in the middle of the Blue Mountains. And the family had held on to that for all those years. And we logged that and sold the logs, I believe it was the Boise Cascade, it might have been Georgia Pacific, for $750,000. And that's what was used to pay the tax. It all went to the inheritance tax, both state and federal, because of the type of situation our family farm was in. We were arguably in the worst tax situation we could have. When we began to realize that, my dad and my uncle, my grandfather had diminished mentally to the point that we couldn't change the will. So they did some other estate things later on to not have a repeat of that. But what this bill does, and the focus on it, is that it would exempt the estate tax for family-owned businesses that pass their entity onto their children or grandchildren. And that could be a small business, it could be a pizza shop, it could be a farm or whatever. But the goal of Senate Bill 304 is to help the mom-and-pop stores and family farms to survive. As our economy becomes more complex, it's imperative that we encourage families to pass along their businesses to the next generation. It'll still be a part of the taxing system. It'll be there. It's just they just have a different ownership. And I hope that this committee will consider this legislation and provide tax relief to small family-owned businesses. Small businesses are the backbone to most of the local economies in rural Oregon. And as legislators, I would hope that we would try to do everything we can to ensure their survival. And I think Senate Bill 304 does. But I'm also in support of the other ones as well. We have a package of different ones that you have a chance to look at. But 304 specifically focuses in on that one aspect of the inheritance tax. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the good fortune of getting to work on this in 09, 08, and again in 10 and 11, as we put together what we now enjoy as the Oregon's estate tax. And we built into it, of course, the credit for farms, family farms. It doesn't apply to all businesses. It's just, I think, it's fishing businesses, timber businesses, and farms. But I don't want to really talk about that at this moment. I think it's, is it 7.5 million per person? So husband or wife, 14 million. Is that right?
I can double check.
Yeah. But what I'm more interested in is at the lower end of the scale, and I want to go back to the remark, Senator Canope, that you made about houses in Bend, because the lower end of the scale is $1 million. And so it doesn't take very long in a hot housing market to get way up above that. And so what we see happening in my law practice is I see people coming in and putting these houses and small businesses into LLCs and then moving to Idaho or some other state that doesn't enjoy an estate tax. And of course, then that personal property is taxed in that other state. And now that requires that somebody pick up and actually leave and establish residency somewhere else. And so I think the state of Oregon is relying upon the fact that most people aren't going to do that. But to the extent that they do, and if you're on a border town like I'm in, I see it happen all the time. And so it's a bad deal for just about everybody, including the person that just left the state. So, but I'm anxious to find out how many houses, families in Bend are now going to be exposed to this particular tax. Now you can go down and get a good lawyer to assist and get away with $2 million worth of house if you manage it appropriately or not. And one of the questions should be, Do we know the total amount of value that's passing each year from which Oregon gets the tax that is paid? In other words, how many people don't go get lawyers as compared to how many don't that actually get exposed to that tax? Is there any chance that do we have the numbers on how much is moving from one generation to the next by reason of death that we could compare taxable estates to? I'll come back to a question for the panel.
I'd have to double check or look into that. Trying to give a source of information. Yeah, I can do some digging.
So I guess the question, Senator Canope, is do you think now that it's fairly normal in Bend or anywhere in Central Oregon to be exposed to a state tax just by virtue of the skyrocketing land values?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Vents. In fact, I have had constituents who have been surprised that when their relative dies, usually a parent, and lots of times our parents don't talk about the assets that they have. And as you said, in a pretty good housing market in Central Oregon, the value of real estate raises pretty substantially in a fairly short period of time. And so there are many houses that are well over $1 million now, and if those are free and clear houses and they have other assets, it's not all that uncommon for the heirs to actually be surprised that in fact that they're going to be now paying this inheritance tax and having to sell assets in order to make those payments. And in fact, I have specific examples where people have come to me and said, I had no idea that my mom, when she died, had more and the house was appraised and sold at X value. And so we ended up having to pay this inheritance tax. And usually I hear about it when something like this gets into the media and it rings true with people. And so I think there's plenty of examples of that. And I think though that we need to, I guess my goal in this is that we don't want to lose the people who have assets from the state and their volunteerism, their donating to nonprofit causes that we have. I mean, we should want to welcome people with assets to the state. And in fact, this policy does the exact opposite. It moves people with assets out of state, even though they come back to enjoy our state from time to time, meaning less than half of the year. And so that's why I bring this policy forward each session. And one of these sessions is going to happen. I'm an eternal optimist. I don't know if this is it, but I think it's going to happen. And the reason it'll happen is because we're going to be in an increasing pool, small pool of 12 states that continue to have this. And the states that don't are going to benefit from our older Oregonians who are going to move to those surrounding states and warmer states than we are, in, especially in Central Oregon in the wintertime.
Well, we have one of these bills, 188, is actually a committee bill that excludes personal residence from the estate tax. And to your question, Senator Benz, it's not just Central Oregon. It's in the Portland area. It is not hard to find million-dollar homes anymore.
No.
A follow-up, Mr. Mayor.
Yes.
So this question is actually for Bill. The in my estate planning practice, much diminished since I joined the legislature, is a common approach on ranches or farms is to identify what we call a sacrifice parcel, which has to be separate because of our land use laws, because you might have a multi-million dollar operation. You're broke because you don't have any money, but you have a multi-billion piece of property. Very, very, very common. And what you do when you first sit down and look at one of those situations is you identify which part you can somehow carve off to sell to take care of these kind of problems. And it is very, very, very difficult if given our land use laws. So you end up with the most awkward of all situations where you don't have any cash because that's not the way farming and ranching works. And am I explaining it correctly to you?
Yes.
And so if you're a generational operation, pretty soon you don't have a sacrifice parcel except for that which you've been using as your as the thing that you, I hate to, the thing to which you are an indentured servant, and you keep working every day, and then you look forward to how you're going to pay that tax. Is that have I described the problem adequately?
Chairman Hassan, Senator Benz, I think that's a very real situation in much of the states, much of our state of Oregon. We didn't have in our farming operation anything we could call a sacrificial. Everything was pretty valuable. And one of the things that my parents and my uncle and others, and we continue to do, we formed corporations so that we got the primary owner not having the majority of the stock type of a thing, which when my parents passed away, that went a long way to help with this particular inheritance tax that we were would otherwise have been faced with. But you're right, there, you've got a variety of ways that you have to try to figure out what to do and how to do it, and that we're gonna, especially in agriculture, in farming, what you identified as your land rich and cash poor. And so when your tax is based upon your assets, you have $1,000 acre farms, but you're not getting $1,000 off of it. And so it's that type of thing that the inheritance is kind of throws everything in out of whack. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hass. I'm just wondering, repealing it, I don't know if that would be possible at this point, but perhaps raising it to a higher number. Right now it's only at $1 million, but especially for the spouse, changing it so that number would be higher, or maybe, I don't want to throw out any kind of number, but what about something like that? I don't know if any of you wanted to be it 2, 3, 4, 5 or something, just a higher number versus completely eliminating it.
Yeah, I get the political realities of building. Eliminating is probably not going to happen, Mr. Chair and Senator Taylor. It looks like of all the states, we have one of the lowest exemptions. We tie with Massachusetts for the exemption rate of $1 million. And then we both have the top tax rate of 16%. I know there's a lot more detail to it than that, but for instance, Rhode Island's fairly low. It's about a little over $1.5 million. But most states go up into the,
higher. Higher. So that would improve it. That would improve it vastly, I think, if we would lift the exemption quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And maybe build in a CPI.
Chair Hess and Senator Taylor, I actually have had a bill like that in the past where it graduates the implementation up to, I think the last time I did it, it moved from $1 million and either $1 million increments or $500,000 increments up to, I think, about $5 million. And I think if you were to move in this direction, being sensitive, obviously, to revenue collections and dramatic impact, I think you would want to gradually get to where we want to go. I understand that repeal is not the most likely scenario this session, but I really do believe that we need to make progress on this as a policy, because I do believe that it is damaging the state and our ability to hold on to Oregonians who really would like to be here and do have assets and do and really are invested in the community. But it just is, as you know, it's a difficult decision for people as they, you know, start getting on in years and, you know, looking to what that's going to look like. And in Oregon, it's not a pretty picture financially. So I think that's a great suggestion.
I wasn't suggesting
that. I didn't know if you were signing on to the bill or an amendment. So thank you.
Pardon me, Senator Hess. Yeah, can I follow up, please? Okay, so I was just asking a question, just for clarification. But second of all, I just wanted to bring to the, I don't, maybe we can have Kyle coordinate with LFO and see, there is a discussion in the Natural Resources and the Subcommittee of Ways and Means about the heritage, the funds that are being considered to help with some of the parcels of land. I think they call them heritage farms. Do you know about this?
Kind of.
Yeah, there's some money being discussed in order to keep large parcels of land together for it's really actually ecological reasons, more and family farm preservation. I don't know all the details about it. I'm just learning about it myself. But there are some environmental reasons why we may not want to have some of these larger pieces of land broken up. And so that's just something to
Senator Buckles, did you want to weigh into this since your name is on some of these?
Has it all been said? Yeah, well, no, I would just echo what Senator Hansel said. I mean, I predate the fine work of the good Senator Benson, then Representative Benson. In our case, as you know, timing's just flat out bad luck. In our situation, as Senator Benz pointed out and Senator Hansel pointed out, is we predated the deal and 100% of the timber either went to the Department of Revenue and the Internal Revenue Service on the ground. And yours truly, I think, ended up picking up $48,000 for in additional taxes out of his own pocket so that my wife can say she has a family farm that's not usable. And of course, we replanted and did all the things, and all of those expenses are nice, fine things to do. But all death is certain, and I'm quite certain I will be dead before we ever harvest any of that. And so therefore, that's walked a working family farm turned into a tract of land that is now 8 miles away from anything we have. And I think, what did you call that?
That was a good term. What's that outcast piece of property?
Sacrifice piece of property. Well, I just had to pay for the sacrifice, and I'm not going to get any of it. So.
And so I am with Senator Canope's position is that, you know, I'd just be flat out. I point out that my colleagues have left and your colleagues from the House that have left over there, Senator, they left all right. They left the building and they left the state. And that's exactly what we're talking about and trying to prevent.
Thank you for coming forward on your sponsor. We have a discussion. It's been a good discussion so far, and we have one coming up. There are a number of people signed up, so thank you.
Thank you.
We are again in public hearing on five bills, 188, 304, 319, 674, and 701. And so because we have a lineup of people, I'll ask you to keep your testimony brief. You don't feel the need to read your comments if you have something you want to submit. And I will apologize in advance for having to leave to take a a meeting with the executive branch down the hall. And so let's start off with Bennett Minton.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Bennett Minton, and I moved to Portland last year. I was captivated by the Oregon vibe. Until then, I'd spent my life in the nation's capital, where I was a congressional reporter, aide, lobbyist, and analyst, mostly in tax policy. For three decades, I watched budget debates and the virtual elimination of our historic tax on wealth transfers. My written testimony summarizes estate tax changes since 1997, which this committee has addressed. But it's worth noting that over 20 years, the top rate has fallen from 60% to 40%, and the unified credit has grown from 600,000 to 22.8 million for couples. One of the 1997 changes eased the burden on family-owned businesses, a more rigorous provision than contained in SB 304. That bill has no limit on an estate's value, and its one-year holding period is a loophole. SB 188 has no policy rationale. Whether a taxpayer stays in a deceased parent's home is not a circumstance deserving a public subsidy. The other bills, 319, 674, and 701, are gifts from the rest of us to rich heirs, or not so rich like me. My great aunt Grace was the youngest of 10 children born in poverty in northern Texas. She built a ranch with her hands and grew wealthy through hard work and smart investments. She had no children, but a ton of nieces and nephews, of whom I am one. Eventually, she sold the ranch. In her declining years, I visited her on occasion. One time when I walked in, she turned her head to me and said, weak but furious, "I hate the estate tax." She knew my business. I went a gentle round with her, my bequest at stake. In the end, she did not cut me out of her will. From my parents, my siblings and I received bequests totaling about $1 million. Some of Mom's money had come from Aunt Grace. We got it tax-free. From Dad, we got some tax-free life insurance and decedent IRAs. I take required withdrawals each year. Despite cash outs of about a third of its original value, that IRA is worth a third more than it was when I received it. I did nothing for any of this money except happen to be born well under a Congress with a fetish for the already well off. At a time of desperate needs in education and housing, with unstable state revenue, in a country with a chasm between the very rich and everyone else, I cannot understand support for additional benefits for fewer than 2,000 of our wealthiest citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Questions?
I have a question.
Mr. Chair.
I don't know where the number 2,000 came from.
I took it out of your state figures. I believe it was around 1,600 in 2016.
People that paid the tax?
People that were subject to the tax. I could be wrong, but that's, I pulled it out of your state figures.
Thank you. Thank you. Kevin Mannix. Excuse me.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I practice business law. I am not an estate planning attorney. I do run an organization called Common Sense for Oregon, which is a nonprofit which has advocated for reforms over the years. And one of the projects we have taken on from time to time is advocacy in support of reform or elimination of the Oregon estate tax. I do think it's important at the beginning of this conversation to take a look at the national scene. And I did provide the committee with a chart. And there were questions asked about this before. Back in 2002, when we saw the beginnings of the changes as to state estate taxes, in 2002, all 50 states still had estate taxes. From 2002 to 2019, 38 states have eliminated their estate taxes. There are 12 states left which still have estate taxes. And of those 12 states, Oregon is tied with Massachusetts for the lowest exemption, which is $1 million. The trend has been for the states which still have estate taxes to increase their exemptions. And when there was some discussion about that figure before, I'd note that those increases have been up to any as high as $11.4 million, which would put the state on par with the federal government exemption. But some are lower, $1.561 million, $2.75 million. There's a variety of figures. But what I would ask the committee to consider is what would be an effective exemption rate across the board in Oregon that would help family-owned businesses, family ranches, and farms. When you take a look at the information we have from the Department of Revenue about the filings for the estate tax, there is a large number of families with estates of less than $5 million who do have to file and pay the estate tax. They are hit hard not just by the tax, which they have to contemplate and make sure that they have the cash to pay. They're also hit hard by being on the verge. If you are somewhere around $1 million value of estate, you need to go through an appraisal process as to all the property, which is costly and cumbersome. So when you are triggered into the estate tax in Oregon, there is that challenge. As to the family residence, we heard some testimony about this. As residential values go up, there are a lot of parents who aren't going to go out there and get an appraisal in the last years of their life. They may not do that. They may not want to talk to their kids about it. But then the family may be surprised to find upon the death of mom and then dad that that house is worth $1.5 million. And, gee, there's no cash to pay it because that was really the main asset of the estate. What I'm encouraging the committee to consider is that there may be some way of trying to benefit lower value estates to get them out of the estate planning milieu where they don't have to go through the process of worrying about this and planning for it. And yes, valuing the capability of a couple to pass a ranch or a farm, a smaller one, onto their family members. We used to pride ourselves on our century farms in Oregon, 100-year-old farms. But if you talk to those 100-year-old farm owners, a lot of them have tremendous value in their property. Here in the Willamette Valley, farmland is now going in some places for $20,000 an acre. And you can pretty quickly hit the exemption levels. Now, we've heard about the Natural Resources Credit, and that was an effort to provide a process by which a natural resource property might be kept together and passed on to descendants. I don't know if you still have the chart available for that natural resource credit, but when you take a look at it, you find out it is, according to what the farmers tell me and what the ranchers tell me, a convoluted and difficult process because for 5 out of the 8 years before you die, you have to have met certain standards, and then for 5 years out of the 8 years after you die, the rest of your family better have met certain standards, and then the credit kicks in. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I would suggest to you, though, that it is very complicated. It costs attorney fees and accountant's work to track all of this and to make sure that those standards are met. So the farmers that I talk to say, well, it's very nice, but we really can't afford to qualify for it. There is a separate bill, and I won't go into detail because it's not in front of this committee. It's from Senator Boquist. It's Senate Bill 468. It's in front of the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, chaired by Senator Dembro, and that actually provides an alternative to the Natural Resources Credit, just in clean dollars. If it's natural resources property and it's passed on to a family member, there is a clean credit, and that might take care of that issue as to ranches and farms and folks who own commercial fisheries. Back to the legislation in front of you. I'm speaking in favor, in a way, of all the bills, but I would note that two of the bills have got relating clauses that do provide you with some flexibility. We know the relating clause issue that comes up in terms of legislation, and as you look at these bills, if you want to do an exclusion as to the residents, well, Senate Bill 188 will take you there, but that's about all that it can take you to. The same goes with Senate Bill 304. That has to do with family-owned businesses, and if you want to deal with that, which is ranchers, farms, and the like, that is a vehicle you can use, which can't be used for just about anything else.
However, Senate Bill 319 and Senate Bill 674 have got that most beautiful of relating clauses relating to estate tax. So you can drive anything you want through those bills through an amendment process if you would like to do anything to tweak the estate tax process. And Senate Bill 701 has to do, again, to the exemption amount, and it's a narrower relating clause. I would encourage the committee to take into consideration what I call the snowbird syndrome. New York has noticed this. New York had a very restrictive estate tax, meaning a high estate tax. And Governor Cuomo took note that more and more New Yorkers were leaving, moving to Florida for more than 6 months of the year, becoming Florida residents. And as Florida residents, they were no longer paying the New York resident income tax. They were paying the non-resident income tax, which means in New York, you only pay taxes on income earned in New York. We have a similar scenario in Oregon. I'm not an expert on the Oregon income tax, but I know enough to know that if you're a non-resident, you're not paying tax on income from outside the state. And if you've had success in life and you have investments and you're receiving money from those investments, which are from out of state, you're paying an Oregon tax on them if you're an Oregon resident. You're not paying an Oregon tax on them if you're now living in Idaho or one of the other 38 states which does not have an estate tax. So the snowbird syndrome caused New York to dramatically change their estate tax. And if we take another look at that chart now, they've moved to an exemption of, I believe it was $11.6 million. It just moved off the chart, $11.4 million. I'm not suggesting that the state of Oregon necessarily needs to move that dramatically in that direction, but it would be helpful if the Department of Revenue might take a look at, without divulging individual information, which they're not allowed to do, how many Oregonians have moved from resident income taxpayer status to non-resident income taxpayer status in a given year, and what was the loss of revenues as a result of their departure. All we have are anecdotes. A lot of us have talked to people, but ask any of your estate planning lawyers' friends what is the first thing they suggest to people who've got a valuable estate: become a resident of one of the other states that does not have an estate tax, and we're losing that income tax revenue at the same time that they're doing what they can to avoid the estate tax. There are complications here. I just bring that to your attention, but I'd earnestly encourage this committee to look for some creative solutions to keep our taxpayers in the state, thank them, and give them a bit of a break when they want to pass some of their family property onto their children and grandchildren.
Thank you, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things that people keep talking about are all the people who move to Idaho. And I know that on our southern border, we have a whole lot of folks who moved here from California, a lot of rich folks who moved here from California to get away from their taxes. When we're talking about all the people who moved to Idaho, are we also balancing that with the people who moved here from California?
Chairman, Senator Riley, I would suggest we might want to ask them, when they move to Oregon and buy a beautiful home with the proceeds of their sale of their property in California, are they becoming Oregon residents and paying Oregon resident income taxes, or are they moving to Oregon and staying here for 5.5 months, enjoying the beauty of Oregon, and then moving back into California for a little over 6 months? California no longer has an estate tax.
Other questions for Mr. Mannix?
I think we should ask him that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Boots.
Because if they're doing that, they're paying California taxes.
Thank you. My name is Eric Frutz. I'm with Cascade Policy Institute. If you go back to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is not that old, the federal government raised the estate tax exclusion from $5.49 million to about $11.2 million per person. That's very similar to SB, which one is it? SB 701. And so if we went that way, we would have something that mirrors very closely what the federal government's doing. However, if you take a look at the information that's provided by LRO, that means that we'd have probably about 25 estates a year that would be actually paying
the estate tax. I think we only have about 25 that have estates with more than 10 million. And that raises to me an interesting question, you know, why so few? And really the main reason why there's so few with estates over 10 million and so forth is because once you have an estate that big, you start doing the things that Senator Bentz was saying you do. You start doing a lot of planning, spending a lot of money doing a lot of planning to avoid those estate taxes. And so really it's a tax on surprises, right? It's usually someone who died way before they thought they were going to die and now they're stuck with a big bill. Mr. Mannix pointed out that, you know, we're one of 12 states that have an estate tax. So if you go back over the past 3 or 4 years, we've had several states have actually gotten rid of their estate tax. In other words, it's a newish thing. Tennessee eliminated theirs in 2016. New Jersey, of all places, eliminated theirs in 2018. Delaware, of all places, eliminated theirs in 2018. And it's not just because it's the right thing to do, which it probably is, but there's also some evidence that's been published in the tax journal that says that this is in response to people who are moving to those areas and saying, you know, we're really scared of the estate tax, and it's their legislatures responding to their citizens. There's this misconception that the Oregon estate tax is exclusively paid by the very wealthy and doesn't really affect middle-income families. But I think it was in the LRO data. I got this from LRO's 2019 Public Finance Basic Facts. They report that more than 90% of all estate tax filings involve estates with a gross value of less than $3.5 million. And of those 90%, they pay an average of about $39,000 in estate taxes. And remember, I don't know if you've talked to financial planners, but, you know, there's kind of a rule of thumb that says you should have probably about $2 million in your, you know, in your IRA by the time you retire. So you can imagine someone dying, you know, soon after retirement. They could have an estate that's subject to that estate tax. And so as it's currently structured, it seems to impose a relatively greater burden on smaller estates than the federal estate tax. And it really falls heavily on farmers, the self-employed, small businesses, even managers and professionals. And so there's a certain fundamental unfairness with the way the system is structured. Now, we've been talking about people moving to Idaho or moving from California, and let's be honest, we have had some positive net migration over recent years. And that's caused some casual observers to say, well, gee, there's no impact of our tax policies, and people keep moving here. But it's clear that our tax policies, and including our death taxes and our estate tax, does reduce retention and attraction of taxpayers who anticipate being subject to our estate tax. So we're considering five bills, and I was trying to take a look at this as an economist. I don't have a sad story to tell about paying the estate tax. I guess I'm fortunate or unfortunate in that way. Fortunate that I haven't had that many people pass, but unfortunate that I don't have anyone that's rich in my family. But if you look at it in terms of what would do the most to actually help boost economic opportunity, jobs, and incomes, I would rank them in order of SB 319 and 674, which eliminate the estate tax. And, you know, that's really nice because it's clean, because now you can move to Oregon and say, I don't have to worry about the estate tax. I don't have to hire an accountant or a lawyer to deal with this stuff. I don't have to figure out which piece of my property to carve off. Remember, a lot of these assets are illiquid. That's probably the cleanest one. Would probably have the most likely to have a beneficial impact. Probably the next one down that had the second most beneficial impact would be SB 701, which makes it more closely aligned with the federal system. It's a very generous exemption, and therefore only, you know, the biggest estates would really be hit with this. But then it raises the question, if you have only, say, 25 states that are going to be hit with this a year, you know, do you really need an entire estate tax apparatus to collect taxes from 25 states? Maybe you should just go whole hog and get rid of the estate tax. SB 304, I think, makes sense in many ways. That's the one involving family farms and businesses. But as pointed out by Mr. Mannix, also that, you know, this is very narrowly crafted. There's a lot of people who would not get the benefit of that tax, and some of those people probably should. So it's much narrower, may not have as big of an impact as we would like. SB 188, I love it as a homeowner, and I live in Portland, so I'm sure by the time I pass away, I will be paying an estate tax, and this exemption would help. But in terms of actually doing stuff, in terms of jobs and so forth, because it's focused so narrowly on residences, it's probably not going to do much to encourage people to, say, build a business or expand a business in Oregon. Although I like it personally, I think from an economic standpoint, it probably does the least of these measures to actually boost the economy. I know there's other people speaking, so I didn't want to hog the microphone, but I'll take any questions if you have them.
Questions?
Yes, please.
Yes, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Benz. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you.
And so your analysis, which I appreciate that, and I was not here when all these various decisions, I'm only halfway through my first term here in the Senate, but I was in the House before for a short period of time, and we are, as I understand it, but maybe you can correct me, I mean, a lot of the reasons why this is here is because we are in a very difficult position in order to have revenue to pay for things. We have 4 million people. We have a lot of people who are very low income. We have a lot of the distribution of wealth. It's a really serious issue here in Oregon, as it is across the country. And we don't have a sales tax. Our property tax system is not, I would say, is broken, and it's not working. It's not yielding the kind of revenue in order to pay for the services that we need. And so although we have a very high income tax, we don't have, again, very many people, and we certainly don't have very many rich people. So it's not yielding the kind of revenue that we need in order to address all sorts of things, infrastructure, basic needs, schools, et cetera. So we need to resort to things like this in order to have enough revenue to pay for the services. So I guess what I would ask is, if we were to remove it, which I don't think that I'm going to be supporting removing it, what is it that we would do in order to make up for the revenue?
Well, I believe the LRO analysis has how much we actually collect in the estate tax. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd be surprised at something like $190 million, if I'm correct. I mean, we're talking about raising taxes by $2 billion for education and $800 mm-hmm. million to fund Medicaid. Mm-hmm. This is pretty small ball in the grand scheme of things. And, it doesn't make a huge difference in the budget, but it makes a huge difference to the people who are paying it. And remember, one of the big problems you have with this is, the wasteful expenditures you have in trying to plan for the estate tax. And sometimes people don't know to plan for it. That's why they get caught with it. And then the other issue, too, that you have with the estate tax is just the idea that there's so many. We've heard about the farming and natural resources, but there's other businesses that have illiquid assets. And so it's a matter of how do you, when you're hit with that bill, even a $39,000 bill, where do you come up with that cash? You may not be able to sell a parcel of land. You may not even have stock in your own company that you can sell because it might be a partnership. How do you raise those funds to deal with those illiquid assets? It's a very clumsy way of trying to raise money. And what it is really it's the state almost taking a bet on a rich person dying without planning ahead. And I mean, I know we like gambling because we like the lottery, but it's probably not a very good way to fund our state government.
Follow up, please.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair Benson, then we can move on. But if you want to, is that it's not just about making up the revenue difference, it's also about the consistent transfer of wealth in our society and wanting to make certain that we don't let that get any more out of control than it already is. And I am concerned about the breaking up of large pieces of land for a variety of reasons. And there are some ecological reasons for that. And there are some other things about that. But it isn't just about those who farm and ranch. It's also about people who just have large estates, meaning that they're just good old-fashioned rich. We can agree to disagree, perhaps.
Well,
but
I'm
concerned about the transfer of wealth in addition to the making up of the revenue. And I, talking about making changes to the estate tax, I just hope, colleagues, that would come along with a conversation about changing some other things in our tax structure. So,
well, I think you raise a good point. One of the issues, though, is, first of all, it's kind of hard to really name a lot of dynasties in the state of Oregon in terms of financial dynasties. I mean, you can name a few, but if you look at them, they've been around a long time, and I bet you almost every single one of them has developed some sort of trust or other apparatus by which they are not paying the estate tax. And again, the estate tax is really catching people who are unprepared for their own deaths. Either they didn't know that they'd be subject to it, or you know, they may be in their 40s and they say, well, gee, I don't have to worry about this until I'm 60, and oh, guess what, I wrecked my car and now I have to pay the estate tax, or my family does, because you know, that's the nice thing about being dead is you don't actually pay it. But I think if you're worried about that, I think that's it's a legitimate fear in theory, but in practice, I mean, again, I don't really see anyone, I don't see any real empire or dynasty in Oregon that has either been stopped or built up because of our estate tax system.
Further questions? Thank you, Eric.
Thanks.
And Marsha Kelly.
Vice Chair Benson, members of the committee, I'm Marsha Kelly. I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Oregon first had an estate tax in 1903, and there have been lots of changes, and we've talked about some of those, the recent changes for the natural resource. And I want to call out the work of the Oregon Law Commission under their chair, Lane Chitterley, who was a former House Revenue Chair member, to work on some of those issues that people talk about losing the family farm. We've heard people talking about people moving out of Oregon, but I know personally people who've moved to Oregon because their kid moved here and got married, and they've brought wealth to the state, and they chose to come here because they wanted to be close to their kids. That's one of the reasons why people move too. Of the states in the District of Columbia, Oregon, yes, is one of the lowest in the exemption rate, but there are only two states, Hawaii and the District of Columbia, and, well, three, two states and the District of Columbia that do have the 11.4 exception that matches the federal. Most of the others are in the fives. So I don't think that we necessarily need to tout that we have the lowest, but at the same time, we do have those monies. The one thing that I would like to mention that has not been mentioned before is in 2012, the issue of phasing out of the estate tax and transfer, gift transfer taxes was on the ballot, and it was defeated by the voters of Oregon. So I think that we could retain the status quo and think about the pots of money that start adding up to that $2 billion that we really do need for the state.
Questions? Thank you very much. And then we have, I'll call it the first names because I can barely read the last, Linda, and Stuart.
You know, I hate the way that I can never read those names. What does it say? It seems like you're illiterate. You're really not.
Vice Chair Benz, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. I'm Linda Navarro. I'm president and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and I'm joined by a couple of our members who have great expertise in this area. So I'll just open briefly and say that we appreciate you actually hearing this issue, and we're here in support, essentially, of all the bills that are on the table, and we also think there are other concepts or ways that you could approach this issue that might not even be reflected in these pieces of legislation. But interestingly, at the Oregon Bankers Association, I've increasingly heard about this issue just in the last couple of years. I mean, it's an issue that's been around, and we've all talked about it for some time. But for the last couple of years, it's been coming up frequently because more and more of our bankers across the state of Oregon are seeing customers homeowners leave Oregon and citing the estate tax as the reason or one of the reasons that they are leaving. And so because of that, prior to the legislative session, our board of directors and membership actually prioritized airing this issue and engaging in this issue as the, one of the things we wanted to do this year. So this these bills are a good opportunity for us to come forward and share the perspective that I think is unique to bankers in being able to see what their clients and customers, small businesses, and Oregon families are choosing to do as a result of Oregon's estate tax. One of the things I'll draw your attention to is this is actually an issue that's coming up all across the state. And one of our small community bank CEOs from Medford wrote a letter that was submitted into written testimony with a couple of examples of customers in that area. He cites Nevada, Texas, and Arizona as three states he's seen his customers relocate to. But of course, we see examples in other parts of the state where they cite Washington, which has an estate tax exemption that's over twice Oregon's right now. It's about $2.2 million. On that note, I just want to say that I took a look at the estate tax summary that you received, and it was in today's testimony as well. I think it's interesting that in 2017, the estate taxpayers, there were 1,326. 68% of that 1,326 estates were actually under $2 million, and they paid a total of 13% of Oregon's estate tax, 68% of those filers. So there are different places, as the question's been raised, where you could even increase this and have a dramatic impact on the folks who might be above that threshold due to their home or a modest retirement combined with an ever-increasing home value. So at the end of the day, I think it is important to realize that today Oregon's estate tax is the most onerous in the country. Kiplinger did a report on estate tax states and ranked Oregon dead last or first on the list of what they called the scariest estate taxes in the country. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and pause. I'm happy to answer questions, but I'd love for you to hear from my colleagues.
Vice Chair Benz, committee members, my name is Linda Thomas Bush, and I am a vice president and senior trust officer with U.S. Bank. I work in the trust department, and I have been there for 41 years, so I've seen a lot of changes in both federal and state laws. I'm also this year's chair of the OBA Finance or OBA Trust Committee. I'm not going to reiterate too much the $1 million exemption and how low that is for the state of Oregon, but I did used to live in Medford, and we did see quite a few people sell their house in California and move up to Medford. But my experience there is that those estates were worth less than $5 million. So first on my list would be to repeal the Oregon estate tax completely, knowing that that is not probably going to happen. Second choice would be to raise the exemption limit. And third choice would be to would be in support of Senate Bill 188, which exempts up to $500,000 for a personal residence. It's not uncommon for a person to pass away, they have their home paid off, and they have a IRA. So the home and the IRA is worth more than $1 million. One of two things has to happen. The kids either have to sell the home or they have to withdraw money from the IRA and pay income tax on that to pay the estate tax. So that's not good for the family. I also have a couple of clients right now. One of them is worth about $25 million. He has a residence in Eugene. He bought a place in Arizona, and he's planning to spend 6 months and one day in Arizona every year to avoid the Oregon estate tax. I have another one who was moving up from California to the Central Oregon market, and he has a business. He was going to bring the business to Oregon until he found out about our estate tax. Now he's going to move it to Wyoming. So those are only two examples. I think what it comes down to is the legislature needs to decide, is a one-time tax more important than 10 to 20 years of income tax for all these people?
Thank you. We'll do questions after we listen to the third member of the panel.
Hi, my name is Stuart Allen, Senator Vance. Thank you for the time today and everybody that came to this. Just for a little bit of background, I've run an independent trust company, and I'm also national president of the Independent Trust Company Association. I grew up, went to community college, had a job since I was 9 years old, and have went to Oregon, and then went on a few years after that law school and paid all of it with my own money. So I'm very proud of that. But I want to talk to you also about what I do for a living. Oftentimes people come in and just basically dump documents on me. I'm not a policy guy, member of the bar, but I'm not a practicing lawyer. And people come to me with their problems and they dump, I see real assets. I don't hear about it. I don't read about it in the newspaper. I see documents. And I kind of identify the estate tax issue as kind of three different segments, how it affects people, small, medium, and large. People, the small, I call them, people with less than $1 million, and they're typically employed by the mediums and the large. The second segment I'd look at is the mediums, and then, of course, then you got large. The large folks, as Linda mentioned, can hire armies of financial advisors and others to help them determine situs, set up trusts, move assets, move states, and so they're kind of not affected by the huge, cruel disparity between the federal estate and the Oregon estate tax. Then we talk about the mediums. And when I talked earlier about me seeing real assets, people come to me with documents. Most of the folks in the medium are illiquid. They have a small business. They have the pizza shop. They have the flower shop. Then maybe they're a plumber. And most of their net worth is tied up in either their primary residence or their business. So it's really greatly affecting them. And so if something happens to them, the business goes away. It's either sold with a fire sale, because the estate tax in Oregon and federally is due 9 months after date of death. So you got to write a check with, even though you have illiquid assets, 9 months after death. So people are losing their jobs that are employees. So the small are losing their jobs because the mediums can't come up with cash 9 months after date of death. So that's kind of a problem for Oregonians. And the estate tax has never been this, this gap between federal and state has never been this big. Right before President Obama took office, the federal estate tax was around $2 million. And when he left office, he signed a bill that made it over 5.4 million. And so we talked earlier about people staying versus leaving, and you talked about revenues and what we need to fund our schools and fund our services. I believe we need to do that. But I also believe that this is one of the reasons that people leave. And like I said, I'm not a policy guy, but what I see day to day, every day, documentation, I think we would get more revenue by bringing business back than scaring them away. And that's not even to mention the folks that don't come here in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I think the problem has been our inability to know, to measure those who would otherwise stay and how much income tax they would otherwise pay. So I guess we'll just turn to Kyle and have him figure that out for us. Right, Kyle?
Yes. Chair Vance, I think that you brought an interesting point up about, this trade-off of if people are going to be, if someone's going to live here and then we'd be able to pay the income tax. One of the other things that, of course, you know that we struggle with here is whether or not someone's actually earning their money with a paycheck. I mean, there is obviously different tax rates. if it's earned income or if it's investment income, there's all sorts of different systems in place, and you know that very well. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, if there was going to be an adjustment in order to make it more attractive for people to come have their wealth, have, and then, but will they actually have an income coming in order for it to be taxed? So that's a little bit of a guess, and it would be hard for Kyle to make that exact estimate, but I mean, I suppose he could come up with some sort of, you know, estimate that we could look at, but I would want to make certain that we were getting some sort of income from those coming here if we were to make changes to the estate tax. So.
Questions? Thank you very much. So we'll bring up the last three folks all in a group. We have Rob, Anthony, and I can't read the first name, so I'll just say Rosenthal. Thank you. Go ahead.
Vice Chair Benz, members of the committee. I'm Rob Siss with Tax Fairness Oregon. I got to say what a privilege it is for me to be in this great state of Oregon, and I'm proud to pay the taxes that I do for that privilege. It's beyond me how somebody would leave the state to save money and not lose more on giving up the quality of life we all are so proud of here. Maybe someday they'll realize their mistake, because I understand we're fast becoming a climate refugee destination state. So we may see them come back here gratefully. That being said, the estate tax has existed since Roman times to level the playing field between the very wealthy and those not so fortunate. When President Theodore Roosevelt expressed alarm about the concentration of wealth and power, he said the objective of the estate tax should be to put a constantly increasing burden on the inheritance of those swollen fortunes, of which it is certainly no benefit to this country to perpetuate. We need to protect against legislative efforts that would tilt the field against the less fortunate, and against funding for common programs and services. And this happens through tax loopholes, exemptions, and credits that enhance welfare at the top, while so many work at lower stratas, paying taxes, struggling to raise families, and trying to make ends meet. Under current law, the estate is taxed at 10% to 16% after the transfer of $1 or $2 million tax-free. It affects 3.6% of taxpayers and raises about $400 million per biennium. These bills would give those who least need it a tax break, and at the cost to education and other basic programs, revenue Oregon needs to fund this state. Much of the wealth being passed on has not been subject to taxes. Homes, land, and stocks, and other investments grow in value untaxed. Much of these assets accumulated thanks to favorable tax breaks, credits, exemptions, and incentives. These bills would benefit a sliver of the population in least need of tax relief. The proposal to index the estate tax exemptions is ill-considered in light of other laws that are not indexed, such as the earned income credit or the minimum wage. 1% of Americans own nearly 40% of the wealth, and 10% own nearly 80%. The situation feeds on itself. The few get richer, the gap to everyone else grows. We suggest that wealth buys a bigger voice and more political power. More and more Americans are left on the sidelines with a smaller voice in their government. The absence of an estate tax exacerbates the division between a moneyed aristocracy and everyone else. A small number of families wield power and influence through wealth handed down from one generation to the next. The estate tax does not affect those who earned and accumulated the wealth, but heirs who did not. We tax Oregon lottery winners. Why not winners of the birth lottery? Let Oregon remain a model for the common good. leave the estate tax alone.
Thank you. I can't recall if I had you state your name or not.
Yes, I thought you did. Rob Siss with Tax Fair and Sorority.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for NFIB, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small businesses. And although 90% of our members have fewer than 25 employees and 70% have fewer than 10 employees, the small businesses we represent account for over 60,000 Oregon jobs. I'm sad that Chair Haas is not here today because I am appearing before this committee in support of all five bills. And I just wanted to note that and thank the chair for scheduling this hearing on these bills. On to my points here. In a recent survey of our members in Oregon, an overwhelming 88% of respondents supported the complete elimination of Oregon's estate tax. The estate tax, it essentially imposes a penalty for small and family-owned businesses to grow the net worth of their business over time, especially for businesses that are preparing to pass the family business on to the next generation. And with all due respect to Vice Chair Bentz and others who help folks with estate planning, the threat of this tax forces small businesses to pay for estate planning services if they want to keep the business in the family, which means that a part of the cost of having an estate tax on the books actually occurs before the tax is levied. Nationally, 34% of NFIB members incurred financial planning expenses in the 5 years leading up to the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And I would expect that number was larger in Oregon because of the differential between the federal threshold and our own $1 million exemption. And that's probably even increased even more. At its worst, the estate tax can tax the family right out of business. The tax applies to property transferred at death, even if the property transferred at death if the value of the property exceeds the estate tax exemption, which in Oregon, as we've heard, is particularly low at $1 million. And while the owner of the estate is responsible for the tax, their heirs are often the ones responsible for the actual payment of the tax upon the death of the owner. For estates comprised mainly of illiquid assets like land, coming up with the cash to pay the tax can be a major challenge. Another thing that we've heard some of the other folks talk about is a recent phenomenon that's come to be known as the accidental millionaire. And this is the scenario when home or commercial property values rise significantly in the years leading up to the passing of the property owner, and maybe even perhaps without a plan for paying the estate tax, leaving the family members in a pinch financially when they're dealing with the loss of a loved one. So Oregon can make an important change this session and lessen the financial stress on families experiencing this kind of loss by increasing the thresholds at which the estate tax is applied, or better yet, eliminating the estate tax altogether. I was struck by the fact that Dr. Fruits also put the bills kind of in order of preference, and I was glad to see that I came out with a similar approach to him in terms of which bills we like better than others. And so I would put Senate Bill 188 as a good bill. That's a great start. I would say 304 and 701 are better bills, and best yet, 319 and 674. But regardless of how the committee wants to approach this, I'll be on hand to work with you on changes, and we'll provide our feedback. And again, very pleased that this topic is up for consideration today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You questions for this panel? I see none. Thank you both. Is there, this is all we have signed up. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on these bills?
Sure, I have a question here.
Fire away, Mr. Senator Boquist.
Is there anyone on your sheet there that's more than 100 miles away?
Didn't say. That's the column.
No.
Just an observation as we have discussions over the next couple of months, and including this right here. Since there is nobody farther than 100 miles away, and there are portions of my district that are 100 miles away, and Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, there's portions of yours that are 100 miles away. All of it. Which is an important part when you have a discussion like this, because my observation is that the state is vastly different. When Senator Hansel's there talking, and everybody that's come up before her is closer than 100 miles, I point out to you, and they're pulled right, looking right at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data right in front of them right here. And you can pick whether you like per capita income or household income, but the dynamics are just the same. The per capita income in Portland, the city of Portland, is about $36,000 a year. The per capita income across the state is about $27,000 a year. And in my district, that per capita income is about $24,000 a year. Senator Benz, I think you know that the per capita income in Malheur County is $16,000 a year. $16,000 a year. Our rural districts are vastly different than everybody in Portlandia in both terms of income, values, small businesses, and everything else. So it's not some they're bad because they didn't pass a tax or they're bad because they didn't do this. There is anybody in this room that wants to give money to Tobias Reed, the Oregon State Treasurer, he can take the money and put it in our general fund. The Bureau of Fiscal Services of the United States government will take it too, and a whopping $775,000 was given to the federal government last year in excess funds. My point is this, is that the policies that we have for one Oregon mean that we have to address policies in rural Oregons and low-income Oregon and in the metropolitan Portland areas. They're not one policy. And so I would just encourage the members here and members of the audience that keep in mind that the schools in Malheur are at $16,000 a year per capita income, and the schools in Portland at $36,000 a year per capita have needs. And we have to approach it in a uniformed manner to address the needs, but we're going to have to do that in a non-uniform manner so we don't hurt the citizens in those districts. Because in my district, bottom line is the small business guys, it's gone. All you got to do is drive down through the city of LC, city of Monroe, city of Dallas, and look around. And unfortunately, it looks like portions of your district out in Powell. I'm Senator, so we have equal problems. But I would just encourage everybody to keep that in mind, that while there are services, we still have people that we have to serve. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. Further comments? No. With that, I think we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 18830, Senate Bill 304, Senate Bill 319, Senate Bill 674, and Senate Bill 701. Nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.